So let me tell you how it starts. You know, I get a ton of newsletters. And actually, at one point, I had gotten up to 16 different newsletters that I got, because I figure all of these different organizations, they have their own clipper services and, you know, pick some of the best of the news out there, because I'm a reader. And in order to stay on top of health and healing, you really got to be a reader, because you've got to stay up on the subjects, and you have to stay up on the new research, and, well, just flat out, you need to stay up on the chemistry. And so whether it's reading nutrition or biology or chemistry or toxicity, I joined the American Chemical Society so I could start reading their newsletter and figure out what the evil enemy was doing to us. But sometimes these things stack up. And a lot of you regular listeners know that I've been off on the road. Last week I was in New York City at a Lyme disease summit. And the week before, I was teaching in Dallas and Houston, and prior to that, I was on vacation, and next week, I go to Minnesota and Detroit. So, you know, being on the road, teaching doctors how to think differently, to think holistically. So sometimes these newsletters stack up. So yesterday, I sat down, read 15 of them. Yeah, 15 of them. So the Cleveland Clinic Heart Advisor and the Public Citizens Worst Pills, Best Pills, and Massachusetts General Hospital Mind, Mood, and Memory, and Tufts University Health and Nutrition Letter, and Focus on Healthy Aging from the School of Medicine at Mount Sinai, and the Center for the Science in the Public Interest, and Science News. Yeah, they're all terrific. And, of course, I came upon one article. And the article got me going through that kind of stream of investigation, and the article was in Science News Magazine. Science News Magazine is the Society for Science and the Public. And the reason that I like Science News Magazine is because it gives you little vignettes. It gives you little pieces in their departments of discoveries in a whole bunch of different sciences. So whether it's astronomy or biology, whether it's anthropology or sociology, math and technology, life and evolution, humans and society, earth and the environment, the brain, just all sorts of different science reports. And it may be that a conference was held last weekend, like the Lyme Summit that I was at in New York, and new information was released at that particular conference. And so they'll put this little vignette in here. They'll put 4, 5, 10 paragraphs about the study that was released on whatever the subject was. Could be jellyfish, could be fracking, could be magnetic imager scanners, it could be friendly bacteria, just all sorts of different things. And I find that these little pieces of information then lead you to more, because this information doesn't show up in the journals sometimes for 6 months, but it comes out in Science News really quickly. And so then if it happens to be a subject that you're interested in, it's going to list the university that did the study or the group or the lead scientists, and then you can go online and you can go further and find the entire paper. That's the way it works. So I'm reading this issue, and the title of the particular article was Heavy Milk Drinking May Double Women's Mortality Rates. Subtitle, Consumption of the Drink Coincided with Higher Chances of Death Due to Cancer and Heart Disease. The widespread assumption that milk is inherently good has arisen despite a lack of randomized trials. So this is right up my alley as a nutritionist. It was listed under the body and brain category. And so in reading this article, which is really profound, a study that was done by Swedish researchers over the course of 20 years who found out that women that drank 3 or more glasses of milk a day were twice as likely to die as those who drank less than one, all other things being equal. The intake of cheese and yogurt and buttermilk and, you know, butter didn't affect it. It was specifically drinking milk. Well, when you look at a really large population in a study, and when you look at a long time in a study, those things are really important as a scientist, because this was 20 years of health data for more than 60,000 adult women. And they provided information on their diet and other lifestyle factors through questionnaires at the onset of the study and then several times over this 20-year period of time. So if they drank a glass of milk with every meal, and I grew up on that diet, you got a glass of milk there on the table no matter what you were eating. Even if you had a bowl of cereal that had milk in it, you still got a glass of milk. Even if you had a toasted cheese sandwich for lunch, you still got a glass of milk. So, and not only was there breakfast, lunch, and dinner, but you might get some cookies at night and have a glass of milk with your cookies. If you came in from school late in the afternoon, you might get a glass of milk then. So it was pretty clear that milk was considered foundational. Well, there's been lots of challenges to that since then, and we're going to explore some of those challenges. But the most important thing is it doubled the death rate. Women who drank the most milk as compared to those who drank no milk were more likely to die of heart problems or cancer or to break a hip. Wait a minute, break a hip? Are you kidding? I thought milk had a lot of calcium in it, and the calcium was good for your bones. Well, here's an irony, wasn't in this particular article, but the four countries that use the greatest volume of dairy products are the four countries that have the highest fracture rate. Yeah, you heard it. The four countries that have the highest consumption of dairy products are the four countries that have the highest fracture rate. So obviously the calcium in the milk is not the whole story. So when the researchers looked at this, dying of heart problems, cancer, and breaking a hip, because remember, one out of seven people who break a hip never leave the hospital, and two out of seven people that break a hip never live unassisted for the rest of their life. So they analyzed a host of factors: age, education, diet, smoking, alcohol, supplementation, whether they took vitamin D, all of that. Well, they pulled up another study that was done on 45,000 adult men that were followed for 11 years, but this was not quite as comprehensive. It did look at the effect of three or more glasses of milk. These men were 10% more apt to die, but they weren't any more prone to fractures or lethal cancer. There's a big difference between these two results between men and women. It's very curious. It might reflect simply weaker data due to the fact that there were fewer men, they weren't followed as long, and they only filled out one questionnaire. So, you know, this is an example where you have to read everything in order to get some meat out of the study. But what's really true is in both instances, no matter what the percentage was, the number of people that died was higher among the milk drinkers. Well, why would that be? You know, there's a sugar that occurs in milk. Everybody knows it. It's lactose. You know, I always do that little cutesy question about where do carbohydrates come from. Well, carbohydrates come from anything that grows out of the ground. Whether it's a fruit or a vegetable or a grain or a bean or a nut or a seed, if it grew out of the ground, it's a carb. Carbohydrate, carbon and hydrate, water. Carbon and water together. C6H12O6, that's glucose in your blood. That's a carbohydrate. And so a lot of times when people use the word carbohydrate, they're thinking of toast and rice and a baked potato and a cookie. They're thinking of starches. But in fact, broccoli is a carbohydrate and lettuce is a carbohydrate. Anything that grows out of the ground is a carbohydrate. So the trick question is, what are the two carbohydrates that don't grow out of the ground? And the first answer is honey. Yeah, honey from the bee. It doesn't grow out of the ground. And the second answer is lactose or milk sugar. Remember, if it ends in an OSE, it's a sugar. So whether it's fructose or lactose or glucose or maltose, all the oses are sugars. Well, there's a sugar called D-galactose that may underlie milk's downside. You know, chronic exposure to sugar triggers chronic inflammation, oxidative stress, rapid aging. We know that. We've known that for a long time, and it doesn't make any difference what that chronic exposure to sugar is. But milk delivers plenty of lactose, which breaks down into D-galactose. If I eat cheese, or I have fermented yogurt, fermented milk products, kefir as an example. It delivers a lot less of both sugars. There's less lactose. There's less opportunity for the body to convert it into D-galactose. And most of the cheeses, especially the hard cheeses, the older the cheese, the drier the cheese, the harder the cheese, the less lactose that's in there because the lactose has been converted to lactic acid. If you have really fresh cheeses like mozzarella cheese, then there's still a fair amount of lactose in there. Same with cottage cheese, pot cheese, farmer's cheese. Those things are high in lactose. So this D-galactose may be the issue that caused the problem because the scientists were also assessing oxidative stress. Oxidative stress, how quick do we rust? Yeah, the metaphor doesn't exactly work, but stay with me. Oxidative stress, how do we break down cells? You know, we can take urine samples from hundreds of men and women in this study and measure their oxidative stress. And people who consumed a lot of milk had higher concentrations of a telltale oxidative stress marker. Men who drank plenty of milk also averaged higher levels of interleukin 6. IL-6 is an inflammatory marker. And IL-6 is one of those things that you can measure in the blood and you can measure in the urine and you can find out whether somebody's doing something that's causing inflammation. Because if you give an anti-inflammatory compound, it doesn't matter whether it's an aspirin or turmeric or ginger or boswellia or acetaminophen and naproxen and all of these various chemical and natural anti-inflammatories. If somebody is continuing to go to Burger Doodle and, you know, eat a burger every day that's firing up interleukin 6, then you're not going to get the inflammation down. Well, it turns out that when they measured these compounds on individuals that were drinking a lot of milk, they had higher concentrations of these oxidative stress markers. They had higher, men had higher concentrations of interleukin 6. Now, it turns out that if we consume yogurt, which I just had as part of my breakfast, or buttermilk, any fermented dairy products, it produced the opposite effect. There was less inflammation and less oxidative stress. Now, that may become happen because the fermented milk products might create a better bacterial profile in the intestine. You know, we are really in the kindergarten age, growing into first grade, on our understanding of what the bacteria in the gut do. You know, it's becoming clearer and clearer that you change the microbiome of the gut and you change the whole body. It isn't just a matter of whether you're pooping or not. The good guy bacteria in your gut can reduce inflammation or increase inflammation globally. So good guy bacteria can lower inflammation in your brain, can lower inflammation in your joint, in your lung, in your skin. We have to understand that everything in our body is all hooked together. You don't just treat one part. You know, Western medicine has chopped the body up into parts. You don't even go to an orthopedist anymore. You go to a knee guy. You go to a shoulder guy. You know, there's five different kind of cardiologists. There's five different kind of urologists here in Sarasota County. So this subspecialty, on the one hand, can make somebody know a really lot about a little bit of the body, but not necessarily know how everything works together. So when we look at this better bacterial profile in the intestine, we're understanding that this is related to obesity, it's related to diabetes, it's related to Parkinson's, it's related, you know, there's just so many things that it's related to. So maybe the consumption of yogurt and buttermilk reduced inflammation, not only because it had less lactose in it and therefore less D-galactose showing up in the system, but maybe it's because the bacterial profile changed as a result. The ability to digest milk is a trait that has been selected evolutionarily as people gain tolerance to lactose. Lactose is a disaccharide. That means two sugars are hooked together. Monosaccharide, like fructose, a single sugar that stands alone. Disaccharide, like sucrose in the sugar bowl, the white table sugar. Sucrose and lactose are both disaccharides, two sugars hooked together. So you have to have lactase to cleave that, a pair of scissors. An enzyme is a pair of scissors. It cuts those two sugar molecules apart. Otherwise, you end up with enough gas to get to Cincinnati. Yeah, that's a joke. So what's interesting to me is that the lead researcher on the team changed his diet. And this is a Swede. He said he likes milk, and Sweden, we like milk, but I changed my diet to yogurt because of these studies. I mean, that what is profound enough to have the study's co-author actually change his habits, to me, that means a lot. So, you know, what's the takeaway here? The thing that I grew up with, a glass of milk with every meal that was popular, you know, that was an Eisenhower administration, you know, attitude. And the American Dairy Association, you know, is one of the people that has the Congress by the nose. The American Dairy Association has the Congress by the nose because the corn growers have the Congress by the nose, because the corn growers have to have a cow to sell the corn to, of course, genetically engineered. So that means Monsanto is now in bed in this whole, you know, nepotism orgy that's going on, because Monsanto wants to sell the Roundup Ready corn to the farmers who want to turn around and sell that corn to agriculture so that they can fatten up the cows, so that you can make sure that you get enough Roundup in your diet, your glyphosate. You know, it's ugly, isn't it? It's just ugly. But suffice it to say, farm subsidies manipulate your diet in ways that you don't even understand. But this blah, blah, blah that we've heard for the last 60-plus years about a glass of milk with every meal should be what we do. And the reason that teenage girls don't have as good a bones as they used to have is because they're drinking more soda pop and not drinking as much milk. And that falls into sort of a gray area at this point. But let's come back to how I spend my Sunday afternoon: reading. So I'm reading this thing, and I'm thinking, you know, yeah, we need to do a show on milk, but what we really need to do a show on is not just the fact that too much milk is trouble, but what's in the milk. Well, I have to tell you, I made an error. And I made an error because I've been talking about the antibiotics that show up in milk. Now, you have a farm, and I have a farm, and she has a farm, and he has a farm, and we all use different antibiotics on our cows. Now, why are we using these antibiotics on our cows in the first place? Are they sick? The answer is no. We're using these antibiotics on these cows because we give them bovine growth hormone. Bovine growth hormone is given to over 85% of the cows in the state of Florida. I don't know what the national standard is, but it's probably close to that. And bovine growth hormone is an injection that cows get 26 times a year. Every 2 weeks, they get a shot of cow crack, as I call it, bovine growth hormone. And bovine growth hormone is designed to get cows to produce more milk. You know, some of these cows are producing as much as 9 gallons of milk a day. Now, you've seen a 5-gallon water jug. So imagine the stress on the animal to produce 9 gallons, almost 2 of those 5-gallon jugs of milk every day. Well, if you take a cow that's out in the Mongolian countryside, they're going to produce about 1.5 gallons of milk a day. So bovine growth hormone is revving up their milk-producing engines so that they produce these 9 gallons of milk a day. Well, as a result of that, they got to be on the milking machine longer. And as a result of that, they end up with more infection in their teats. And so because they have more infections in their teats, they're given more antibiotics. And they're given the antibiotics prophylactically. They're not even waiting until the cow has an infection in their teats. They just shovel the antibiotics on top of the food. And shovel is the right word. Because remember, 80% of all the antibiotics that are manufactured in the United States are given to livestock. So, you got a farm, I got a farm, she's got a farm, he's got a farm, we're all using slightly different antibiotics on our cows, but we all sell our milk to a milk cooperative. So it all goes in one big vat. And when it goes into that one big vat, then there's 8, 10 kinds of antibiotics that are in that milk. And so I've made the statement before that the federal government did a milk buy, and they found as many as 16 antibiotics in one quart of milk, and that's true. But there's new news, and that new news came out in March. And that new news, because antibiotic resistance is undoubtedly one of the very biggest concerns that those of us that are healthcare practitioners have in the last couple of years and in the future. Antibiotic resistance, you get an infection that an antibiotic can't kill. You know, we had 23,000 deaths that we know about in U.S. hospitals last year, or 2013. That's the last year we have statistics for. There's a big downside to the overuse of antibiotics. People still use these medications haphazardly. You know, they get a little and they go to the doctor and they get an antibiotic. So it's part the practitioner's fault and part the client's fault because they want something to be done. And people think that antibiotics are going to help everything. Doesn't matter whether you have a rash, doesn't matter whether you have a cough, you know, there's an antibiotic for it. Now, don't get me wrong, antibiotics save people's lives. They've saved my life. There isn't any question about the fact that there's a value to antibiotics. You know, I talked to doctors that were in practice in the 1940s when penicillin came out, and prior to penicillin showing up, one out of every two people that had pneumonia died. So no wonder penicillin was considered a miracle. But what we've done is we've evolved bacteria faster than we've evolved antibiotics, that's for sure. We've evolved bacteria hundreds of years in the last 60 years by killing the weakest and leaving the strongest behind. So that's how we end up with MRSA and VRSA and who knows what else. So many antibiotics turn up in this cow's milk, which makes milk unsafe for human consumption, because then, even if you're drinking a glass a week, not just a glass every meal, you're getting a little bit of those antibiotics in that milk. And as a result, you're making the bacteria that's in your gut resistant, because you're going to kill back weak ones and you're going to leave the stronger ones behind. You know, I call it the 98 cockroach theory. It's not a pretty theory, but it goes like this. I have 100 cockroaches in the box. I spray in bug spray. 98 of the roaches die. Which two live? Well, obviously the ones that have resistance. Obviously the strongest bugs in the box. So now I push the box in the corner and I leave it for a month, and a month later I got 100 cockroaches again. And I spray the same bug spray that I sprayed in the first time. But this time 98 of them don't die. Maybe 30 of them die. Because the two super roaches that survived have now bred a generation of super roaches. So I have to get an extra strong bug spray. I spray it in the box. Another 68 of them die, so 98 of them are dead, two live, and then you see where we're going with this. This is how we create antibiotic resistance. Well, the mistake that I made was that I kept citing yesterday's news. Yesterday's news was the fact that the federal government, and it's true, had found up to 40 different antibiotics in milk. It means milk would be unsafe. But what's actually true is that it turns out that after thousands and thousands of evaluations of milk, only 1% of the milk actually had antibiotics in it. Now, granted, we don't want any antibiotics in the milk, but 1% is a little less scary than just making the statement antibiotics showed up in the milk. So when we start to look at the nature of how we read the news, antibiotics and other drugs can end up in the milk when they're used on dairy cows to keep them healthy. Small levels of these drugs are allowed in milk, but residues that go beyond a certain threshold are illegal. So when the agency tested 31 different drugs, almost all of them antibiotics, it showed that only 1% of the milk actually had any of these drugs in it. So you're hearing my message. We don't want any drugs in any milk. When the FDA said 11 of the samples from the group with previous violations showed illegal levels of drug residue, and 4 in the control group showed illegal residues, the illegal drug residues found in the study were from unapproved drugs where any level is illegal. The study was blind, so no violations were going to be reported. But the FDA first announced way back in 2010 that broad testing of the milk supply was going to be done. Well, that's one way to look at it. But, you know, if you go on Dr. Google, and I don't know what it is with people's brains, that they think that because it's on the net, because they find it on their computer, it's automatically true. Like there's this big screening filter in the sky that makes sure that everything that gets printed is absolutely true. So right under the news release that shows that there really isn't much antibiotic showing up in milk anymore, there actually has been a change within the industry to reduce the total volume of antibiotics and to make sure that the milk is screened for it. Right underneath it is another headline about banned antibiotics still being in the milk. And so just a few days after the first news release came, this news release came that said, and I quote, antibiotic resistance is undoubtedly the biggest concern that's pestering healthcare practitioners. Pestering would not be a word I would choose. Since the last few years, and while several studies point out the downside of overuse of antibiotics, people are still using these medications. It has now been found that many antibiotics are now turning up in cow's milk, which is actually making milk unsafe for human consumption. Recently, the FDA conducted a survey of milk samples to check whether farms were finally turning to pure milk. They tested milk samples from 2,000 dairy farms, half of which had a history of violation when it came to the rules. These milk samples were screened for the presence of 31 different drugs, and it was found that the residues of 6 of these drugs were found, and the most commonly found residue was the antibiotic fluorphenicol. What's shocking is the fact that all of the drug residues that were found were actually not approved for use in lactating dairy cattle. While the presence of these banned substances in milk is alarming, considering the fact that the number of violations is low, the researchers believe the current policies are working as they should be. FDA is now continuing to look for ways to eradicate the illegal use of drug by dairy farmers and will expand their testing to include more drugs that then could be detected in milk. Antibiotic traces are often found in milk since they are used on cattle to keep them healthy. However, residues that exceed the threshold are considered illegal, and if consumed for a long period of time, they could also prompt allergies and reactions. So here are two different news releases, both on the search page for a Google engine about milk and antibiotics, one of which clearly states that the number of violations that were found was incredibly small out of 2012 different samples, but the other one only emphasizing the fact that residues were found, implying that they were found in lots of samples instead of less than 1%. Now, I don't think 1% is acceptable. Don't get me wrong at all. But it shows the bias slant. It shows the bias slant of, oh, it's all bad. And, hey, we're doing a better job than we thought we were doing. And that's the part that I think we need to emphasize. I do think we need to emphasize the fact that the American food supply is one of the safest food supplies in the world. But there's other reasons for us to be concerned about milk. Dairy products are one of the most common foods consumed around the world. And whether it's cow milk, goat milk, sheep milk, or what's coming into popular, you know, highlight now, camel milk. And if you haven't had your glass of camel milk today, well, you need to think again. But dairy products are also inflammatory foods. You know, one of the things that's amazing to me about GERD or reflux or heartburn or sour risings or anything that you want to call the acid coming up instead of going down, 50% of the people, if I get them off dairy products, they never have reflux again. You know, when Little Miss Muffet sat under Tuffet and separated the curds and the whey, the curds became cheese. The whey they used to put in a saucer and feed it to the cats. But casein is the protein that makes up about 80% of the protein in milk. Remember, milk has about 1 gram of protein per ounce. I'm talking about cow milk. There's different amounts of protein in other milks. You know, if I compare goat milk has a tiny bit more protein in it than cow's milk. You know, if I compare soy milk, it has a tiny bit less protein than cow's milk. But if I look at almond milk and rice milk, you know, they barely have any protein in them. So when we begin to look at casein making up 80% of the protein that comes out of cow's milk, it's 209 amino acids that are hooked together. Now, what you want to picture is one of those really long phosphate trains that you can get to a railroad crossing in Central Florida and park your car and do a crossword puzzle while the train goes by, because there are literally hundreds of cars in the train. Well, when you think of a protein as a paragraph. And the protein is made up of letters. The paragraph is made up of letters. The letters represent amino acids. So you've got 26 letters, but they make thousands of different words, and you can put them together in all kinds of combinations to make a paragraph. Well, we have 20 amino acids. You can put them together in thousands of ways, and you can make them into different proteins. But generally speaking, a protein is at least 100 amino acids long. But in the case of casein, it's 209 amino acids long, strung together in a sequence. And there's two different forms of casein, A1 beta and A2 beta. They're nearly identical in structure, except one of those train cars is different. Instead of a box car, there's a tanker car. In other words, you just change one amino in the whole sequence and you have these two different kinds of protein. Okay, that's your chemistry for today. When we break apart these aminos, again, think of having a pair of scissors and taking it to the paragraph. You cut the paragraph into sentences, you cut the sentences into words, you cut the words into letters. That's called digestion. You take this great big protein and you cut it into pieces. They're called peptides, and then you cut the peptides into individual amino acids. And as you're breaking these bonds, just like the couplings between the train cars, you create these things called peptides. And there's all sorts of different peptides that are created, but one of the peptides that's created when you digest milk is called beta-casomorphin 7. Casomorphin, and you hear the word morphin, you think about morphine, because it's an opioid. It gives morphine-like qualities. It creates rampant oxidative stress in the gut and in the bloodstream. It's an amino acid that some people can't degrade. They can't break down very well. And so this response, this process is taking place in the gut. And so it can cause digestive stress. It can cause leaky gut syndrome. It can create intestinal permeability because this peptide is resistant to being broken down. Well, when this beta-casomorphin 7 passes into the bloodstream, it can cross the blood-brain barrier. And in the brain, it can bind to opioid receptors. And it can create everything from symptoms of schizophrenia and autism to all sorts of mood and neurodevelopmental disorders. We know that both autistic and schizophrenic type behavior changes can happen in animals that have been injected with BCM7. So this A1 beta casein, this one casein that is created that shows up in milk and shows up in the products of milk, has been linked to type 1 diabetes. We know that you don't give milk to a baby under 12 months old, not cow milk, because a child who's given cow milk under 12 months of age has 14-fold greater risk of creating type 1 diabetes. That's insulin-dependent diabetes. So we know A1 beta casein has been connected to digestive disorders, to neurodegenerative disorders, to type 1 diabetes, to heart disease. There's lots of evidence linking them to A1 beta casein. So why can some people deal with this? Well, their enzymes work better. It's pretty challenging to enjoy dairy products and avoid A1 beta casein. You'd actually have to look for a specific breed of cow. There's a cow called the Bos taurus subspecies, which is the primary breed of cattle that exists here in the Western Hemisphere. But Guernsey breeds make very little beta casein, while Jersey breeds produce more. Holsteins produce even more than that. Goats don't produce A1 beta casein. So their milk and their dairy products that come from goat don't have this as a risk, and that's why some people can eat goat cheese and have goat milk and have goat yogurt and not have any issue with it, but they have an issue with it when they have cow products. And so when I say that it can create wacky doodle brain, I can remember the very first, actually it was before I was even in practice. When I was working with Dr. Jan Davis up in St. Petersburg, years before I established a practice here in Sarasota, which is now 27 years, she had a patient, and I had come into her practice to work with some of her patients. And Dr. Davis had a patient that had what looked like classic bipolar. She was literally two people. And this was before the term bipolar was really used. They called them manic depressives. And this was a woman that as long as she stayed dairy-free, she was very stable. But if she had any dairy products, and I mean, you know, a spoonful of cream and a, you know, bowl of tomato soup, she would start getting aberrant behavior. Well, she was one of these people that this BCM7, this beta-casomorphine 7 molecule, this peptide that comes when you split casein, actually acted like morphine, like an opioid in her brain. She got high. And she began to change personality. And as she fell off the pier, she would want to drink milk. Then she would want to drink half and half. Then she'd want to drink full cream. Then she'd want to eat an entire block of cheese. And I heard this story from Dr. Davis, and I was like, yeah, 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 because it just sounded, you know, like a TV script. But in fact, one day, this young woman came to Dr. Davis's and had one of those little half-ounce containers of half and half that you put in your coffee, the ones that sit on the table in the restaurants. And she had been dairy-free for 90 days, and it's the longest that she'd ever gone, and she was completely stable. And she wanted to do this experiment in front of Dr. Davis. So she opened up this little half-ounce, you know, not even a tablespoon, what's in there, a teaspoon and a half of half and half, and drank that little tiny container, and I'm here to tell you that it's the closest thing to a spook show that I have ever seen. It's the closest thing to a nightmare movie that I've ever seen, because I saw this woman in 20 minutes change right before my eyes, change her facial features, change her voice, change the way that she spoke. It was absolutely astounding, and it was scary. It was really scary, and I was really happy that I was in the presence of an MD who had some skills as to what to do with this, and actually she isolated the young woman in her own home for 48 hours until this whole thing passed. The woman never took dairy products again, never had to use drugs again, and maintained stability. But, whoa, beta case of morphine for some people is big, big trouble. That's why some people who have autistic children, children that are on the autistic syndrome, they take kids off of gluten and they take kids off of casein, because caseomorphin is formed and gluteomorphin is formed. Both of these can act like opioids. In whose brain? We don't know. We don't know. There's no way to look at somebody and know. And you may not register a sensitivity to milk on your food sensitivity test or your allergy test, because caseomorphin is produced during the process of digestion. You're not actually eating caseomorphin. It's part and parcel of another molecule. So it only shows up in the digestive process. So it's very difficult to test, although there are today tests for it. So let's go back to where we started here. I'm reading an article that says women who drink 3 glasses of milk or more a day double their rate of death from heart disease, cancer, and hip breaks. And from there, I went to look at the antibiotics that were in milk. And from there, looking at the dangers of A1 beta casein. And from there, to look at the dangers of raw milk. I have clients that come into my practice today and they talk about raw milk as it's the best thing since sliced bread. They talk about the wealth of nutritional benefits that can happen with raw milk. You know what? We don't live in the same environment that we lived in 50 years ago or 100 years ago in terms of bacteria. You've heard of what happened with the people who've died as a result of eating Bluebell ice cream. 3 people have died that they know about. A whole lot of them have become sick. Well, there's a lot of people that are going, well, when you have raw milk, that solves the problem. No, excuse me. If somebody reacts to beta-caseomorphin, they're going to react to beta-caseomorphin, whether it's in pasteurized milk or raw milk. But the pasteurization that Louis Pasteur brought forward to kill harmful bacteria has saved tens of thousands of lives. But there are harmful bacteria, and there are stronger harmful bacteria than they used to be. They're badder bugs. They're badder bugs because of the antibiotic resistance that I talk about. So whether we're talking about Salmonella, E. coli, or Listeria, which is what caused the Bluebell ice cream deaths, I mean, you probably heard the update on that, that they found Listeria in this factory several times over the prior years. They're going to have a big wrongful death suit on their hand. These things cause lots of foodborne illnesses. And so, you know, we can look at statistics and we can say about 2,000 people in the United States became sick from drinking raw milk or eating cheese made from raw milk, you know, over the last 20 years. That number doesn't seem really high. You know, that's not 100 people a year. But that doesn't count how many miscarriages happened as a result of Listeria, because Listeria will commonly cause miscarriages, crib deaths, deaths of infants. The nature of Listeria in pregnancy is, you know, the miscarriage, the fetal death, or the death of a newborn. Yikes. You know, I have to warn some of my clients about Mexican-style cheese like queso blanco or queso fresco. It can harm that developing fetus even if you don't feel sick. But you want to remember that times have changed. 2 big things have changed in terms of milk and in terms of consumption of dairy in general. One is the majority of these cows are not now eating genetically engineered corn. Cows aren't designed to eat corn. Cows are designed to eat grass. That's the reason they got a couple stomachs. They ferment it. They break it down through fermentation. That's one of the reasons cows are gas factories. That's one of the reasons that the methane that the cows produce from cow gas is a big contributor to the climate changes that we're having. When we look at the fact that we're putting genetically engineered corn, genetically engineered soy into these animals, the exposure to glyphosate, you know it is Roundup, that's in the Roundup Ready corn, the Roundup Ready soybeans, alters the gut microbiome of the cow. And in altering the gut microbiome of the cow, we've created E. coli's that can kill people. E. coli is a natural and normal part of your digestive process. It's also what causes urinary tract infections, because it's supposed to be one compartment in the body, but it's not supposed to be in the other compartment of the body. But now, when we created E. coli 0157, that's the ones that killed the people at Taco Bell years ago. That's the ones that killed people that ate the spinach that was processed under a roof, an open barn, right down the road from a great big bunch of cows. Well, if you have a great big bunch of cows, you have a great big bunch of cow poop. And that cow poop dries out and blows some of those bacteria over to the open barn where the spinach was being processed. So the salmonella, the E. coli, and the listeria that show up now are badder bugs than they were 20 years ago when glyphosate was released. I'm concerned about the dangers of unpasteurized milk. And so when I hear people that talk about all these benefits that come from it, you know, there's something to be said for realizing that humans are the only animals that take milk after weaning. Every other animal on the planet, that mammal that feeds from its mother's teat, once it weans, it doesn't matter whether it's a puppy or a kitten or a gorilla. Doesn't matter if it's a whale or an elephant. Doesn't matter if it's a possum or it doesn't matter. After that animal is weaned, it never drinks milk again. Now, I don't want to give up my cheese. I don't want to give up my yogurt. But think about it. Wasn't milk simply a product that was designed by nature to feed infants of all mammal species? And once that mammal is weaned, we don't go back and take milk again, even from that species, much less another species. So, you know, it's hard being a nutritionist. You can hardly leave the house without somebody asking why dietary advice is so confusing. When I did my class on Saturday, I said that the issue today is we have too much information. It isn't that we don't have enough information. You know, I've said it 1,000 times. On Monday they said eggs were good for you. On Tuesday they said eggs would kill you. On Wednesday they said eggs were good for you again. No wonder people doubt. And what's true is eggs are good for you, especially the yolk. We should be throwing away the white all these years and eating the yolk instead of doing it the other way around. I can remember when nuts were once considered too fatty to eat in any significant amount. And then they went, oops, people who eat nuts live longer. Now, I'm not talking about the toffee-coated nuts. I'm not talking about the beer nuts. I'm talking about raw and lightly toasted nuts. You know, spread them on a tray, put them in the toaster oven through one toast cycle, and that's enough. No, I don't want dry roasted nuts. They're heated at 600 degrees. You alter the fats on them. But what we look at in terms of these things changing in nutrition, part of it is science and understanding. We're understanding now about beta-casomorphin. We're understanding now more about these bacteria like Listeria and E. coli and Salmonella and the hazards that they pose, however slight. You know, 16,000 people died last year as a result of taking aspirin and naproxen and ibuprofen and acetaminophen. 16,000 people. 23,000 people from bacteria we can't kill. You know, these are profound numbers, and yet people are afraid of sharks. You know, sharks kill a handful of people every year, but we kill 70 million sharks. It doesn't make any sense. You know, we're afraid of terrorists. We're afraid of the boogeyman in all sorts of different ways. Hey, it's these bacteria that we should be afraid of and be afraid of anything. So when we look at nutrition science, we don't get to lock people up in a pen for 70 years and feed them a certain way and see how it comes out. You know, a lot of studies are done on animals. Well, animals aren't miniature people. They have different lifestyles. They have different dietary habits. But it does give us some insight as to what's going on. But industry influences nutrition studies. Food is big business. And remember, big food is big agriculture. And big agriculture is one of the triplet children with big pharma. And so big ag, big food, big pharma, they're triplets. They're the children of big chemistry. And the food industry leaves its fingerprints on every piece of research by the way that it funds, the way it pokes holes in the research behind any unfavorable findings. You know, if your university gets a huge, big amount of dollars from Kellogg's and you came out with a study that said sugar pops rot your brain, you're not going to get any more money. You know, the National Cattlemen's Beef Association lobbies the U.S. Department of Agriculture to change dietary guidelines, telling them, don't tell them not to eat red meat. So why is nutrition advice so confusing? A lot is because the Corn Refiners Association, the group that makes high fructose corn syrup, they're the people who are funding studies, funded by Pepsi-Cola and Kraft and ConAgra Foods, funded even by the National Institute of Health, trying to say that there's no difference between having Kool-Aid drinks and having drinks that are sweetened with NutraSweet and having fruit juice. Industry-funded studies actually got high fructose corn syrup in their milk. Kind of an odd study when we consider how many of the population can't tolerate lactose. So the lobbying, the industry influence is one of the things that makes it harder and harder for us to look at all of these studies and dig through these studies and find out what the truth is. And yet we rely on some of these studies because they give us some insight, especially when they're done over 20 years, especially when they're done with 60,000 people, like this study that was done on 3 glasses of milk a day. What's a girl to do? Well, you look at nature and you ask nature, is milk consumed after weaning? Not by any other animal. Well, that may be a clue right there. Maybe it's not a food that's designed for us. Maybe those of us that are Northern Europeans that didn't have as much of an opportunity to get other sources, develop that lactase enzyme better than Native Americans or Asians or Black Africans. And so as a result, we may do well with digesting milk and cleaving that beta-casomorphin protein, whereas somebody that comes from a Southeast Asian culture isn't able to do that. Somebody that comes from a Native American culture isn't able to do that because they didn't evolve over 10,000 years with drinking reindeer milk or whatever. Look at nature. Nature's smarter than all of us put together. Nature's smarter than all of the scientists in the world. Nature is smarter, but we got to pay attention. And that's why we want to eat foods that grow. That's why there's no better way to evaluate what's real food than by asking the question, does it go bad? Fruits and vegetables rot. Milk goes sour. Meat putrefies. If it goes bad, it's good. If it doesn't go bad, it's not good. Some of this stuff is real simple.